If Nehemiah armed his workers in the face of opposition, what does that mean for the followers of Jesus? Welcome to The Good Word. I'm Alden Thompson, your host and study guide author, as we continue our series on Ezra and Nehemiah. Our topic for this week is facing opposition. My conversation partners are Brant Berglund, Dave Thomas, both teachers in the Walla Walla University School of Theology. So, let's take that opening question. Nehemiah armed his workers. Should we arm the members of the church?
This is a really difficult question, and especially in light of who Jesus is and who he came to be and what he taught his followers, there, I think, is little, I'm not saying no, but there's little room for God's followers to other than trust him to take care of his people. But it does seem like maybe there's times when, if needed, strapping a firearm to your side in our culture just as a show of resistance or opposition might be appropriate. I'm not saying that we need to call to arms. That's not my position on it. But I do think that,
or carrying a spear in some other places.
Sure, yeah. Jesus even told his disciples after the Lord's Supper, you know, if any of you lack a sword, sell your cloak and go buy one. Was he meaning, many people turn that into a spiritual sword, go buy a copy of Scripture. That can't be what it's saying. And I'm wondering, was there opposition that maybe just bearing a sword might have stopped banditry and allowed the word to go forward? But that's a difficult question, Alden. It's difficult.
I want to know if Alden has an answer to his own question.
Well, I grew up, you know, I was not even allowed to use a water pistol because my folks, amazingly, they had Republican inclinations, which normally was, you know, strong defense. Mm. But at the personal level, I couldn't even use it. My dad was a physician, and we would use 20cc syringes from his office. They shot a lot better.
That was my brother and I, too. My dad was a physical therapist. My mom was a nurse. They'd come home with all kinds of things that shot, but it wasn't guns.
Yeah, that's right.
It wasn't until I was older and our family had a 22 for the farm and a 12-gauge shotgun, and that was for the farm, right, for the orchard, not as weapons of defense.
But I do believe that the ideal, certainly, is to turn the other cheek, go the second mile.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think that's the ideal, but how often are we not in the ideal circumstances? Yeah. You know, I knew a man once who was supposed to pastor a church in a very tough neighborhood. He was afraid for his life, and so he asked permission to buy a shotgun and turn in the expense account, and the conference agreed. So he carried this, he had the shotgun in his possession. He didn't always carry it, but he said, there are times when my life is at risk. If I don't have this, people will overrun me. If I have it, they'll leave me alone.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Now, he never fired it.
Well, and Alden, let's ask a practical question about Walla Walla University. If we knew that there was a rogue group out who intended harm to Walla Walla University and wanted to prevent us from being a Christian university, and they were willing to do things with arms, would we not ask for a police presence, armed police presence? No. Now, I do find that a bit shocking then that as we're not Jews, but as Jewish people might invite Gentiles to do work for them on the Sabbath they wouldn't do themselves, I'm hoping we might be better than that. And if we would ask armed officers to come, why would we ourselves not be willing? And that's a tough question. And again, I don't have a good answer for it, but if we knew that people were wanting to stop the work and use those sorts of means, and all it would take was just a show of we're going to resist, we're not going to allow you to walk on us. I don't know.
Well, I think if there were a sniper, for example, that were picking off students, you see, I think it would be quite appropriate for a sharpshooter
to take a few rounds back the other
way.
Yeah,
to let them know we're not going to stand
absolutely
for this. But see, this is the work of rebuilding the wall, and the opposition was, and we could argue that we live in a different culture and a different time, and maybe that's the case. The work that we face opposition to generally isn't of a physical nature, at least not in our country.
Yeah.
Maybe in other places it is.
But I do think also that weaponry has changed, because in Nehemiah's day, everything was hand-to-hand, face-to-face. Now you can destroy somebody halfway around the world who you've never even seen.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you do it by pushing a button, so to speak. But, you know, personal combat is very different than this abstract
stuff. It's become very impersonal.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, moving back from the physical opposition, and I think that's crucial. They had certainly physical opposition in Nehemiah's day. But what is the value of opposition to personal development? Huh. Now we're talking about character development.
Well, if I think about opposition just in my physical workout, you know, I don't lift a lot of weights, but I do a little bit to keep myself in shape. I like to cycle. Without resistance, there's no muscle building. Without resistance, if you're in space and you don't push back against something, you will atrophy. And maybe the same is true spiritually. In fact, I spoke with a young person right after my Daniel and Revelation class today, and he comes from a different spiritual tradition than I do, different faith. And he says, you know, my dad's a pastor, and he actually prays for America to be faced with a lot of persecution so the church will actually become the church. Huh. For him, he says, persecution actually develops the people of God.
Yeah, and anybody who's been through a hard time and suffering and through challenges will tell you that the amount of growth that takes place is huge compared to what happens when there's all peace and quiet. So,
well, I've had people tell me that even though they don't like it, that their greatest growth as a result of the difficult times that they've gone through.
That's always the case.
Yeah. And there's an Ellen White quote from Ministry of Healing, page 500, that intrigues me. She wrote, "Man can shape circumstances, but circumstances should not be allowed to shape the man. We should seize upon circumstances as instruments by which to work. We are to master them, but should not permit them to master us. Men of power are those who have been opposed, baffled, and thwarted. But calling their energies into action, by calling their energy into action, the obstacles they meet prove to them positive blessings. They gain self-reliance. Conflict and perplexity call for the exercise of trust in God and for that firmness which develops power."
Mm-hmm.
I think that's a very good reading of human nature. Now, we've talked already about the circumstances in which we might want to carry, but one of the things that I think we ought to take a look at here, because the opposition from Nehemiah had to do with the Samaritan schism. And we often don't look at the roots of that. This is one of the few places where the Bible gives us some clue about the origin of canonical divisions. You go to 2 Kings 17, the Assyrians had this well-honed practice of keeping down rebellion by transplanting people. They would bring people from another place into an area and take the people from that place, transplant them to another nation so that it would keep down rebellion. Here in the Walla Walla Valley, for example, we know where the steam tunnels are. We know where the things are in the mountains. We would be able to defeat any kind of invaders. But if they brought in people from New Mexico and from Canada and from Kentucky, they wouldn't know. See? So that's where the origin, and it's really quite fascinating to read the story, because what happened as a result of this, they, first of all, when they got there, it said that the people didn't know the God of the land, and there were lions that killed some of them. So they asked for a prophet to come, and he taught them about the law of the land. See, but these people also worshipped their own gods. So what happened is that you get a combination of mixed blood and mixed religion.
Mm-hmm.
Now, these were the people who came that wanted to help build the temple. And that was where the Jews who came back
said, "You have no part with us."
Yeah, we have no part. So,
and that turned into generational animosity.
Yes, and by the time of Jesus, I mean, these Samaritans, as they eventually became, were deeply troubled. Now, ironically, maybe not ironically, Jesus went out of his way to help those Samaritans, mm-hmm, and to affirm those Samaritans. Now, as we go through the lessons here this quarter, we'll want to draw some contrasts between Ezra and Nehemiah and the stories of Jesus. And that is perhaps one place where we can see the contrast. Jesus took a radically different approach to the Samaritans. Now, my question is, when is it safe to accept help from non-believers, or does the danger of compromise always make cooperation dangerous?
The broader narrative here about the group on the other side of the river, as they're sometimes called, is troubling, because while they may have helped, in the end they were huge opposers to the work. And I wonder if they had their own agenda that would not have been consistent with that of Nehemiah and Ezra. I wonder if they wanted to insert their own politics and their own way of life, regardless of the racial tensions that would have existed by mixed blood, which we are going to see as well, right, in the end of these books. But it seems to me they may have had their own agenda.
Yeah, there are certainly clues there that they did not have the same agenda as Ezra and Nehemiah.
But see, Alden, I think that's a clue, because if you need help from outsiders and they aid your agenda, then I don't see much danger in accepting it. But if they use it to undermine it, then it's a huge problem.
Or if they want to redefine your purpose and your goal, right, your mission statement.
And that's why even a question of proportion is significant. For instance, in Adventist schools, if you get too high a proportion of students who are not believers, then it becomes very difficult to model. It's much easier if you have a good solid nucleus that can model things for the others. Now, prophets to the rescue is the heading I put in my notes here. God sent two prophets, Haggai and Zechariah, to encourage the people to build the temple. They pointed out their task of material prosperity, that their lack of material prosperity was no doubt linked with their unfaithfulness in religious practice. So, thus, the temple was finally completed.
And this played out over some 40 years, right?
Well, I don't remember the time frame, but it was when they finally built the temple in 515. Now, they started to build when they first came in 535 or so.
Yeah.
But it wasn't until 20 years later that they actually
came. And these are two prophets who prophesied for a relatively short time. It was not a whole lifelong experience.
Yeah, it was a very short period of time.
But it is interesting, the end of verse 2, and the prophets of God in chapter 5 of Ezra, and the prophets of God were with them, supporting them. So it's always nice to have a prophetic vision, isn't it, to help morally rally the people.
Now, I've wondered about the role, and I think of this because when you look at the story of Jesus, while he will sometimes thump the Pharisees, for the most part, his approach was pretty positive.
Conciliatory. Yeah.
That's right. And again, Ellen White comments at this point, and at one point in the church, those who present the eternal principles of truth need the holy oil emptied from the two olive branches into the heart. This will flow forth in words that will reform but not exasperate. The truth is to be spoken in love. Then the Lord Jesus, by his Spirit, will supply the force and the power. That is his work. That's sixth volume of the Testimonies, page 123.
And commenting on Zechariah, the prophet Zechariah, when he talks about the oil.
Yes, that's right. So do you think it's possible to get, for the most part, positive? The Lord wants his people to follow other methods than that of condemning wrong. And it will flow forth in words that will reform, but not exasperate. We may
I think that's a very good strategy, and I think it works as long as things are not so far out of kilter that people are afraid and won't react to positive things.
Yeah.
Well, our time is up. Thank you again for your help. And thanks to Abby Wissink, our program engineer, and for all of you for listening in. For The Good Word, I'm Alden Thompson.
You've been listening to Good Word, a production of the School of Theology at Walla Walla University and KGTS-FM. To order a copy of today's broadcast, you can call 509-527-2194. Thanks for listening, and we'll be here next week at this time with Good Word.